How did we get from this?
Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee.
To this.
A bunch of revolutionary manumission abolitionists. Give me a position, show me where the ammunition is.
The answer is a century of dismantling racism. I'm Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. This podcast, I'm going to be talking with Jess again, because this is the second in the series on the American musical. Hello, Jess.
Hey, guys. So excited to be back. I know that people were breaking down your door to have me back, so it's good that we give the people what they want.
I thought, this month, just do musicals and gaiety and song and dance and take all your worries away. Only then I started researching the 20s and 40s, and it's not that. It's not nice at all.
Yeah. So, super problematic time in our history, really.
So we're going to enjoy some music that I think we both enjoy, and then also talk about how horrible the whole history of it was.
My favorite topic, so let's do it.
So I'll, right off the top, and I'll give another warning later, but right off the top, I'll tell listeners, I am going to talk about historical views. We're going to talk a lot about the racist heritage of American music, and when I'm quoting from things and when I'm reading off of things, I'm going to use the historical terms that people used. I think it's a disservice to censor history and pretend like, you know, if we use euphemistic terms and stuff, then it just kind of implies that history was less horrible than it actually was. And I think if we're going to explore historical time and place, we should use the terms and look at how people actually talked about these things. So just a heads up, if you don't want to hear a bunch of like racial slurs, then maybe don't listen. But I encourage, like, especially if you're like white, this is a part of our history that we really need to take a hard look at and understand why it was so hurtful by actually listening to it and looking at it. So that's part of why I've chosen to write this in some of the ways that I have.
This is your official trigger warning, though, and you're allowed to excuse yourself. This is
yes,
this
exactly.
Is it.
And I'll give you another warning once we're closer to the more racially sensitive parts of this. So we're going to mostly talk about the musicals of the 20s through the 40s, and I'm going to use Cole Porter's life as the structuring device for this.
I'm so excited. I don't know much about him.
So Cole Porter, he was the only surviving child of a wealthy family, and his life shows a lot of the marks of that privilege. He grew up with a doting mother who strongly encouraged his musical talents, first on violin and piano, and then as a writer. And at age 14, he shipped off to a boarding school and brought along with him an upright piano and found that his playing and singing made him the center of a wide social circle. In college, Porter's social life really took off. The connection between music and his urbane nightlife comes through in many of his songs. So a major hit of Porter's has this verse dropped because it's too risque even for us sometimes today.
Some they may go for cocaine. I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, it would bore me terrifically too. Yet I get a kick out of you.
We hear the I get no kick from champagne a lot more than the I get no kick from
yes!
cocaine.
Oh my god, the cool cocaine stylings.
Yeah, that was Sinatra. Yeah.
Wait, was this still the phase though where cocaine was like sold at pharmacies for headaches and stuff?
Yeah, a lot of this was like right after the FDA is coming into effect, and so a lot of like you can still get like more like Bear's heroin, Bear's brand named heroin you can get at the store at this time.
Oh my god. Wait, was that the best heroin on the market then? Was Bear's
so,
heroin?
So it's just morphine, and Bear created, you know, Bayer was one of the like first major branders of pharmaceuticals and like putting pharmaceuticals in people's homes, and heroin was their brand name morphine that became very, very popular for Americans.
What a time to have been in your early 20s.
Yeah, right. And then one of his most famous songs, It produces, it's basically an impressionistic song of what a party sounds like. So this is when it was recorded in the 50s by Sinatra and Bing Crosby.
What frails, what frocks,
what broads,
what furs, what rocks,
they're beautiful.
Why, I've never seen such gaiety.
Neither did I.
It's all just too exquis, really.
This French champagne,
domestic,
so good for the brain. That's what I was gonna say.
You know, you're a brilliant fellow.
Thank you.
Pick up, Jack.
Don't dig that kind of crooning, chum.
You must be one of the newer fellas.
Have you heard it's in the stars? Next July we collide with Mars. Well, did you ever? What a swell party, a swell party, a swell again.
That's what a party sounds like.
A swell-again party, no less.
Thanks for pulling that out, 'cause that's what I'm pivoting to.
Excellent.
He had a soft spot for the silly. Swelligant was one of his favorites that he's deployed in a few songs. And one of his most beautiful compositions is based entirely around a silly language joke like that. So if things can be delicious and they can be delightful, then they can also be de-lovely.
The night is young, the skies are clear, and if you wanna go walking, dear, it's delightful, it's delicious, it's de-lovely. I understand the reason why you're sentimental, 'cause so am I. It's delightful, it's delicious, it's de-lovely. You can tell at a glance what a swell night this is, romance. You can hear dear Mother Nature murmuring low. Let yourself go.
That's a good one. I like that one.
You can tell that it's the music of an English major. Now that I know he's an English major, it all makes sense.
It's a really good point. That is the kind of crap that you see in McSweeney's.
You can tell he was just like, making up my own words over here. Yum, yum, yum.
Porter's first Broadway play, See America First, opened in 1916. The book was written by a friend of his from school, and critics acknowledged that it had a certain limited appeal. The New York Herald wrote, it would be delightful as a college play. And the Tribune wrote, Gotham, which was a nickname for New York at the time, is a big town, and it may be that the sisters, aunts, and cousins of its Yale men might be sufficient to guarantee prosperity for See America First.
Those seem very personal. Like, they're specifically targeting him in their critiques. Wow.
During the time that Porter was starting to make music, American popular music was dominated by marches and by patriotic type music.
Really?
Another major figure in American music was John Philip Sousa, who you would know from marching band stuff, but he also wrote for Broadway. He incorporated his enormously popular march, The Washington Post, into his operetta called El Capitan. Sousa also was a big fan of Gilbert and Sullivan, and he adapted the Mikado, which you heard bits of last time. He turned it into a march, so let's listen to that just because that's weird. You're against marching bands, the Mikado?
This is so strange. I don't approve of it. It's as if you were, like, running a prison and you made all of your prisoners march. And it would be Gilbert and Sullivan.
We're going to do the Mikado now. Gaiety, make it gay.
Exactly. I do not approve.
So this is the state of American music as Cole Porter is coming onto the scene.
This is a strange place.
So what he's doing is pretty different from what is already on the scene at that time. Sheet music was really big business. Most cities in America had one or two major publishers of sheet music, and these publishers took their cues from the hub of pop music publication, which was a block in Manhattan that was called Tin Pan Alley. This is what Porter is referring to in this song.
This verse you've started seems to me The tin pantithesis of melody.
The opposite of Tin Pan Alley, the tin pantithesis.
So was that in reference to what they were sold in? Do you know?
There's different theories about the name, but the connection has something to do with there being a whole block of upright pianos banging out different tunes at the same time. As we move into the era of recorded music, Tin Pan Alley continued to be this major engine for bringing composers and producers and performers together. Many of the plays that ran on Broadway were reviews. So this is a performance where a collection of songs, either by a particular writer or by a publishing house or in a certain style, are performed together. And there's usually skits or even sometimes maybe a plot that might connect these songs. But they were pretty loose. It was mostly just a collection of songs. And this informs the kind of play that Cole Porter wrote. The songs were paramount and they could move around in the show. So when these plays are performed today, sometimes songs are moved around in reference to the play or given to different characters. And the key thing is that these songs had a separate life as sheet music that existed outside of the plays that they were a part of. They were also pop music, essentially. The music took on greater significance, though, in 1916 and 17 as the nation ramped up for war. As part of the massive recruitment and justification effort that Wilson initiated, an enormous thirst appeared for patriotic music, both from audiences and because there were hundreds of new military bands that were suddenly created. And actually, surprisingly, the military effort in World War I from the U.S. placed a relatively high significance on music. They gave musicians relatively high positions, and they felt like it was crucial to having good morale. And that would be a key part of what would change the war for America's favor is how high our morale was. So now we get back to Porter, because believe it or not, Porter shipped off to participate in World War I. So a year after his, and let me repeat this, a Gilbert and Sullivan style parody of a patriotic musical that somehow flopped in 1916, the year that we're gearing up for war.
I'm as outraged as you are, frankly.
he shipped off for Paris, because that's what you do when your musical flops. He apparently served with the French Foreign Legion, which is considered improbable by many Cole Porter historians. But the French Foreign Legion has his portrait on their website and in their like hall of portraits, so they accept that Porter was a member of it. But most of his time was spent at his luxury apartment, entertaining the Parisian society. It was with, quote, much gay and bisexual activity, Italian nobility, cross-dressing, international musicians, and a large surplus of recreational drugs, according to one biography.
That sounds like a great time. Yeah, I don't know much about Cole Porter, but I did not have a mental picture of him as a sexually easy to define character. Was I correct
yes,
in that?
Yeah, very okay. Correct. Cole Porter was able to move more freely in Paris away from his Yale community. Most biographers agree that he was gay. Most also agree that he had romantic and sexual interactions with women. So the term for that kind of person is bisexual. Bisexuality is even more erased by historians than homosexuality is. Cole Porter had apparently meaningful romantic relationships with men and women.
So confusing.
Linda Lee Porter apparently lived in fear that her husband's well-known homosexual romances would ruin both of them.
Wow.
Porter liked to party, and he had the money to do so, and he loved the outrageous. Many of his songs gave voice to changing ideas about sexuality in the 1920s. So Jonathan Katz in The Invention of Heterosexuality, which is a really good, you should check it out. It's a really good book. It's about how the concept of heterosexuality came to be as we understand it today.
I love that idea because it really like the idea that gayness or bisexuality or queerness of any kind was invented in our modern times is crazy.
And it's more about inventing the normal that was supposed to be heterosexual and inventing that out of what used to be just procreation, which was just marriage and babies, and marriage and babies was the norm, not sexuality. That was a very new concept. So he describes this time as the great coming out of heterosexuality.
I love that.
Others have called this the first sexual revolution, but if it was a revolution, it was confined to the white, the straight, and the middle class. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's ironic, or maybe it's fitting, how many gay and bisexual composers, writers, and artists created this world. Cole Porter broke ground with his boldly sexual lyrics. He reintroduced himself to Broadway in 1928, partially at the urging of his wife for them to go home to America, with a new musical called Paris. And its centerpiece became one of Cole Porter's signature tunes.
Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams, against their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
So apparently the producers of the musical made him title it Let's Do It, Let's Fall in Love, because that line break between those two, that ain't accidental.
Big difference, yeah.
This is a pretty intentional break in the song there.
First, I love the song. And second, I feel like it's still a spicy song to this day. There's... like, it's still, like, a little scandalous. Yeah.
So Paris, there was, like, lots of reworking and lots of rewriting of it. He fretted over it endlessly before it went out. And he replaced... he put in Let's Do It. It replaced another song that's very similar that eventually also became a hit.
We're all alone, no chaperone can get our number. The world's in slumber, let's misbehave. There's something wild about you, child, that's so contagious. Let's be outrageous, let's misbehave. When Adam wore Eve's hand, he wouldn't stand for teasing. He didn't care about those apples out of season. They say the spring means just one thing to little lovebirds. We're not above birds. Let's misbehave.
We're not above birds.
I love that fucking literalizing. And also the implication that, like, we're not morally superior to birds. Keeping in mind, so these are really great and fun things. Let's also keep in mind the overall context of what's happening. This will be your first trigger warning. A lot of it's around black slurs, but here we get some Asian slurs. And this is the original first verse of Let's Do It, and this is how it was performed until, like, the 40s or 50s.
And that's why chinks do it, jacks do it, up in Lapland little laughs do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love.
So that's how he chose to start this romance song.
The juxtaposition of her beautiful voice and that awful lyric, it's very jarring.
It is. Yeah. So strap in. We're going to hear a lot of jarring stuff here in a second. So Cole Porter's sexual language is bold, but it's still euphemistic. The advantage is that these songs can be applied to either gender, and reworkings of these plays can sometimes change the gender of the singer or turn them into duets. And this ambiguity actually helps the songs live on so well past their time.
Do we know if the racial slur was just supposed to be funny, or was there something, I don't know, any, like, was it related to the topic at all?
So I mentioned that he did that ballet that was about quotas, about immigration quotas.
Right.
And then also a lot of the song, so the section that we listen to is like the seafood section, but there's like a races section where it's like Spaniards do it, where he just lists lots of different like cultures using the terms that were current at the time. So I don't even know if it was like demeaning or anything. I think it might have just been the terms that were used for people from Asia.
That was just the language, like it was completely appropriate to say that.
So I think it might have just been purely like, you know, in Asia they do it, in Europe they do it, in Africa they do it.
Gotcha. Yeah. The seafood section, by the way. I just... Even those lazy jellyfish.
Yeah, even those motherfucking jellyfish that just float around like assholes all day. So the title song to his hit play, Anything Goes, talks even more explicitly about the changing of the times.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking, what a looked on as something shocking. But now God knows anything goes. Good offers too, who once knew better words, now only used for letter words, writing prose. Anything goes. If driving fast cars you like, if low bars you like, if old hymns you like, if bare limbs you like, if Mae West you like, or me undressed you like, why nobody will oppose. When every night the set that smart is intruding and nudist parties in studio, anything goes.
So that's the voice of Cole Porter himself.
Really? He has such a good voice.
That's him singing. Yeah. It's got a very particular kind of like transatlantic like pronunciation to things. It's definitely a Yale man. Let's just say that.
Sounds like he's not that distantly related from the royal family with that voice.
And that's what we're going to get into next is the black heritage of American music. So here is the second, or I guess third, trigger warning of we're going to get into now what people actually said about the influence of black music in American life. And so you're going to hear me say slurs in reference to what people wrote and talked about at the time and using these things academically. So what is jazz and what does it have to do with musicals? Jazz, broadly understood, is a subculture. It's an aesthetic, it's a music, and it's a performing style that developed in black American communities and came to be the main American musical idiom of the 20th century. It reigned supreme in pop music until the 1960s, and it left an indelible effect on the music of our symphonies and our musicals. So these influences reached their confluence in New Orleans, where a quick succession of innovators popularized blues, ragtime, and finally jazz to popular audiences, which here I mean specifically white audiences. Louis Armstrong and Jelly Roll Morton created early blues and swing styles of jazz, and the increasingly affluent and respected cultural hub that was Harlem contributed Duke Ellington and Cab Calloway, among others. In 1963, the great black American composer Duke Ellington told a journalist, "Listen to that chord. That's the Negro's life. Dissonance is our way of life in America. We are something apart and yet an integral part."
Yeah, how interesting that someone had declared that this new style of music was essential to the American experience, and yet they were not considered, like the people who created it were not considered an integral part of the American experience at all. Like, how insane must you be to not put those two things together?
Exactly. One of the most remarkable and original achievements of this confluence of jazz and symphony music was first performed in 1924 as part of a concert that was called An Experiment in Modern Music. George Gershwin, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants who grew up in a tenement in New York City's Yiddish Theater District, was rocketed from Tin Pan Alley song plugger to the darling of the academic musical world overnight. We're told that audience members such as Igor Stravinsky and John Philip Sousa were losing patience towards the end of this 26-piece long concert in a stuffy, hot auditorium in the summer when a clarinet glissando shocked the room. The piece alternates between solo piano and orchestral sections. The orchestral sections were written out, but instead of a number of rests, the score simply said, "Wait for nod." Gershwin didn't commit his piano part to paper until after the initial performance, so it's possible that he was still improvising up to and during the first performance. We can hear both symphonic and jazz influence in the treatment of the solos and the huge dramatic scales that seem to both be tonal and atonal and just continue forever. The piece represented a landmark in American music, seamlessly blending the uniquely American jazz movement to the European canon of great composers, which Americans always felt kind of shut out of as composers. You can hear in this piece both the jazz club and the sound that movie music was going to imitate for the next 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So despite the black origin of jazz and its enormous black influence, virtually all jazz composers of the 20s and 30s were white. Alex Ross writes in The Rest is Noise, quote, "To tell the story of American composition in the early 20th century is to circle around an absent center. The great African-American orchestral works that Dvorak prophesied are mostly absent, their promise transmuted into jazz. This wasn't caused by a lack of conservatory-educated, affluent black musicians and composers. In fact, some black musicians learned from great universities tuition-free as a kind of limited form of reparations. The issue was not the quality or availability of black composers. The issue was a musical establishment that refused to take black compositions seriously, and a concert-going audience that shunned black composers. Black composers didn't fare much better on Broadway either. Showbiz was condescending towards black music in an even more overt way. So when the musical made its leap to the silver screen in 1927 with The Jazz Singer, it did so in blackface. Al Jolson, one of the all-time most popular American singers, starred in a story that was not dissimilar to his own life. The protagonist of The Jazz Singer grows up destitute in a Manhattan Jewish ghetto and finds himself torn between seeking his fame and fortune in showbiz and staying true to his Jewish roots. In the end, he reconciles with his parents and sings his signature number, My Mammy. One of the first movies with synced recording of film and sound, Jolson was said to have shocked audiences when his character declares, "You ain't heard nothing yet." The final scene fades between Jolson singing his heartfelt rendition of My Mammy in blackface, while his mother is crying for joy in the front row of the audience. And it sounds like this.
Mammy, my little Mammy, the sunshine's east, the sunshine's west, but I know where the sunshine's best. It's on my mammy I'm talking about, nobody else's. My little mammy, my heartstrings are tangled around Alabama.
It's not an accident that the first musical performance in film is blackface. This wasn't some kind of fluke. Jolson continued performing in blackface through the 1930s and continued singing these songs through the 1940s. In film, he's usually cast as an old guard, song and dance kind of man, and his blackface performances are depicted as like this nostalgic past of vaudeville that we're now losing. It was a main form of stage comedy, and it incorporated a wide range of acts, including singing, dancing, comedy, trained animals, magic, strongmen, acrobats, jugglers, and minstrels. American vaudeville inherited much of its traditional acts from minstrel shows. So let's go into that. Minstrel shows were a preeminent form of American entertainment in the early and mid-19th century. These performances had a certain structure that made them similar to other comedy revues. So, like, there would be silly stump speeches that satirized politicians of the day. There'd be sections where high art, like Shakespeare or opera, were simplified and turned into pop songs so that people could enjoy them. And this was where a lot of slapstick comedy was really developed. It would maybe be something that we still perform fondly today, like the way that Punch and Judy is done in the UK, except that minstrel shows were set on plantations, portrayed slaves as lazy and dim-witted, glorified the supposedly easy life of the slave, and they were acted almost exclusively by white performers in blackface.
Great.
Like most comedy revue performances, there were stock characters that could be used to communicate quickly with the audience what kind of character they were portraying. But the stock characters for the minstrel show were the mammy, the old darky, the black soldier, and the provocative mulatto wench.
All right.
Yep, we're getting into it. Minstrel shows were popular before slavery was abolished, sufficiently so that Frederick Douglass described blackface as the filthy scum of white society who have stolen from us a complexion denied them by nature in which to make money, pander to the corrupt taste of their fellow white citizens.
Wow.
It's hard to understate just how explicitly degrading and dehumanizing minstrel shows were. I think we can pretty much get the picture, though, from this clip of one of those comedic satirical stump speeches. So you'll hear it is supposed to be like political satire, but overwhelmingly, by far, it's making fun of the supposedly loose grasp that black Americans had on the English language and to mock the idea that black people could participate in politics at all. So this was recorded in 1902.
Readers of the Lime Kilt Club, on this conspicuous momentum, on this glorious occasion, I want to confess upon you that the whitewash brush am mightier than the sword. And in declusion, e pluribus onion.
So this is our history.
Yeah.
As white Americans.
Yeah.
Doing shit like that.
Yeah.
So the part of minstrelsy that Al Jolson participated in most was a genre of music called the coon song. This form arose in the mid-19th century. Across Europe and America, academics and artists were delving into folk traditions. This is part of the rise of nationalism. They were resurrecting and popularizing and codifying national traditions. So things like the Brothers Grimm codifying fairy tales was part of this movement. Many folk songs were written into musical notation for the first time. And this, of course, was affected by the training and the ear that the transcriber had. They were fitting things that didn't exist in Western notation into a clearly defined way of describing it that could be replicated. In many ways, folk songs were warped to fit academic models of pitch and rhythm. And of course, America being so dominated by racist slavery, this process was extra racist in America. Coon songs were essentially white impressions of the folk music of the South. By 1880, sheet music for coon songs was big business. We can see this as the first phase of a recurring theme in pop music. So in the 20s, jazz came to dominate pop and symphonic music. In the 50s, rock music took over. In the 80s, hip-hop and rap became central to pop music. So we can see this as a recurring thing where white America falls in love with black music over and over again. And this is maybe the first variation of that, when sheet music for coon songs took over the country.
And they were popular because the songs were actually popular, not just because it was like mocking of some tradition, right? Like that, or, I mean...
Yeah, let's explore that. So the lyrics were set to black melodies and to black rhythms as best as these, you know, folk interpreters could get.
Yeah.
But the lyrics were usually new. Okay. And the big hits of the coon song were, and I'm sorry about this, but I'm going to say them. Every race has a flag but the coon. All coons look alike to me. And nigga love a watermelon, ha 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 ha.
Wow. We have to just pause for a second here to reiterate the fact that this was badly transcribed folk music sung by slaves, mostly about surviving probably religion and the conditions that they were living in, repurposed with racist lyrics that made fun of the very people that the music had originally been created by. I just need to take that in for a moment because it's so deeply upsetting.
And they were outrageously popular. These are some of the best-selling pieces of sheet music ever.
Whew.
Black performers were not entirely excluded from showbiz, and this is maybe the worst part of the story. Some found success within the coon song genre. So Ernest Hogan, one of the first famous black American performers and composers, was the author of All Coons Look Alike to Me. And he later in life explained where he saw himself in the history of music. So he said, "That song caused a lot of trouble in and out of show business. With the publication of that song, a new musical rhythm was given to the people. Its popularity grew and it sold like wildfire. That one song opened the way for a lot of colored and white songwriters. Finding the rhythm so great, they stuck to it. And now you get great hit songs without the word coon. Ragtime was the rhythm played in back rooms and cafes and such places. The ragtime players were the boys who played by ear, their own creations of music, and they would have been lost to the world had I not put them on paper."
So he saw his participation in it as subversive in some way, that even though it was like racist at the time and terrible and inexcusable and awful, it opened up other doors in the future.
And there seems to be definitely a value placed on these black composers and songwriters of like, yes, this is being treated in a horrible way right now, but we're still getting our rhythms and our songs and our ideas into white culture somehow. And so that was kind of like a silver lining of participating in this era of entertainment for Black people.
And I mean, I think, not that I would ever cast any judgment, but it's also like, what other option was available? It's not, as a Black musician, you were going to go, well, this country's racist. I'm just going to go to another place that's not, that isn't. You operate within the system, and that's really the only option that you have available to you.
Several Black composers and musicians worked within the minstrel show form as part of their quest to be included in American music. The first all-Black musical debuted in 1897, and it was entitled A Trip to Coontown. It ran off and on for 3 years with controversy amongst white playgoers for having an all-Black cast, and amongst the Black intelligentsia for repeating racist stereotypes. The composer, Bob Cole, struggled to find success with his later musicals that were funded by Black producers and eschewed these racist stock characters. And he committed suicide by drowning himself in a creek in 1911, in his 30s.
Wow.
We do get more Black composers and bandleaders in the public eye as we start to enter the 30s. So now we're moving past the 20s into the 30s. Cab Calloway was able to make his name in entertainment and on stage with his own perspective on the jazz tradition. So he starred in Stormy Weather, Porgy and Bess, and Hello, Dolly. And he was a pretty major figure in both the play and in jazz music. And his big hit happened in 1931.
Hey folks, here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a low-down, hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail. Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Heidi, heidi, heidi-ho.
Heidi, heidi, heidi-ho.
So part of the reason why I didn't play many recordings of those two Black composers that I just mentioned is they don't exist. We finally do start getting recordings of this music in the 30s as Black people start getting a platform of their own in pop music slowly.
Yeah. Well, it was so good.
Yeah.
Love a jazzy call and response.
Well, the thing you need to know about Minnie the Moocher is that she's a low-down hoochie-coocher. The music of the 20s to the 40s stands at these crossroads. So we have the more sophisticated jazz, and we have the coon song, and they're both white appropriations of Black traditions at this point. There are amazing works by Black composers during this time period, but very few are in musical theater, and very few have been recorded. Instead, theater music was written mostly by Jewish immigrants, like Irving Berlin, or by Yale graduates like Cole Porter. Their great success was due to their ability to fold the popular coon song, the more sophisticated jazz and symphonic music into the pre-existing American tradition. So the song that's often hailed as Cole Porter's greatest work, I think, shows this in this confluence of these three influences really clearly.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day, today and...
You're a monster if you don't love that.
Yeah. Gershwin had a complicated relationship with Black culture. So his fame was built on his masterful handling of jazz as high art with Rhapsody in Blue. And he had a close friendship with Duke Ellington, and he collaborated with Black peers to tell their stories, and he promoted Black peers to help them find platforms for their work. The fact remains, though, that he first rose to prominence with this song. It's a rag song called Swanee.
Thank you.
So you're like, oh, it's a nice ragtime song, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's Gershwin playing it. So yeah, that sounds fine. Now let's listen to it with lyrics, as sung by Al Jolson.
Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I'd give the world to be among the folks here. D-I-X, I even know my mammy's waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee.
It suddenly sounds a lot more racist.
Yeah, that really puts a damper on the enjoyment.
So this is the conundrum that we're forced with as, like, you know, historians or just people interested in the past. There's no way to separate the Rhapsody in Blue Gershwin from the Swanee Gershwin.
Yeah.
They're the same person. It's the same kind of music. It's the same tradition. So as much as I would like to say that there were, like, more respectful parts of it and less respectful parts of it, you know, these were being produced by the same people.
Yeah.
And this was, like, the same culture that was being shared across.
And he was trading in this tension on purpose. Surely this is purposeful. This is popular lyrics. This is going to get people's attention.
Yeah,
you can't erase that fact.
Yeah, so this was his way into the public mind. Like, Rhapsody in Blue arguably couldn't have happened if he hadn't been famous from Swanee.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it may be worth mentioning that Jolson, like a lot of other white performers who were consciously doing black music, he insisted that black co-stars receive equal billing, receive equal pay, and he insisted they not be segregated when they go into clubs, which was the major custom at the time. Even if the work itself was overtly racist, the performers and musicians were often on the front line of desegregating entertainment. We tend to focus on the performers and writers of these problematic works of art because they're the face and the words that we're actually hearing and seeing with regard to them. But these artists are working within creative industries that ultimately have limited control over what they create if they want to reach that elusive level of success that allows us to talk about them decades later.
Yeah. And pandering to an audience that wanted it. I feel like the audience makes out scot-free in these stories sometimes when,
yeah,
when that's completely untrue. It was demanded.
Yeah. So, yeah, the system that creates George Gershwin's and Al Jolson's, it's complex and it involves business interests of investors and it involves the tastes of audiences. And the hard truth that I've come to is that, like, American performers and writers and artists often did what they could to include and promote black peers while they were still operating within this overwhelmingly racist paradigm. It's an ongoing project in American culture to break down that capitalist cycle between investors and audiences that creates this kind of privileging of white work over non-white work. So I think we need to look at something like Al Jolson singing in blackface more as a statement about American society than a statement about Al Jolson himself. One of Gershwin's most ambitious works was an opera called Porgy and Bess. It opened in Boston in 1935, and it tells the story of a destitute black community in Charleston. Porgy falls in love for the sultry Bess, and loyally provides for her as she goes from romantic interest to romantic interest, from thug to drug dealer. Unlike virtually every prior Gershwin work, the play was not a critical and commercial success. Opera critics hated the show tunes, showbiz critics hated the dissonant operatic sections, and black commentators found it, no matter how well-intentioned, to be really condescending and appropriative. It's not hard to see why. Although attempting to show the fullness and drama of black lives, Gershwin gives voice to all kinds of unexamined prejudice. The lyrics are almost entirely written in dialect, as in Gershwin's interpretation of what black people sound like when they talk.
Never a good idea, Gershwin. Never a good call.
He tried to have the whole book, the whole play part of it, in dialect as well. And the black performers, it was almost all black performed, refused. And they cut it back to just being in the songs instead of throughout the script.
Don't you, like, want in that moment, was he not like, I don't know, maybe we should reexamine this whole thing if my own performers are refusing to perform because they are so offended by the lyrics and the words?
So it caused a falling out between him and Duke Ellington, because the Duke insisted that a white man could not write the great black opera of our times.
I mean, it's sad to me that we even need to say that, yes.
Ellington himself struggled for many years to write his own black opera, but he found himself unable to compose long form. His whole career was based around being a band leader and working with really talented jazz musicians, and he found the process of writing an opera too solitary to be workable. And sadly, Gershwin died the following year at age 38, shortly after doctors removed a large brain tumor from his brain. He never heard the new life that his work found after his death, because in 1957, Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong recorded Porgy and Bess and gave it a new life.
Summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high.
So that's the other thing that's so difficult about American cultural history, is that we have to accept that George Gershwin is the creator of Swanee, Rhapsody in Blue, and Summertime.
Such an incredible song. But I think, don't you feel reaffirmed by the fact that it was only made popular by two incredible black performers who retook it, who performed it and made it, like, that to me feels like success. That to me feels like how it should be. That they
there's definitely a shift that we see.
Yeah,
happening. Yeah. And like I said earlier, some of these platforms were created by, you know, in the 20s and 30s, they weren't allowing a lot of black performers in, but it did create these platforms that later black performers would use. Mm-hmm. So there is also that part of their legacy. But that's a little glimpse into the future. We're going to hop just back a tiny bit and finish up the Cole Porter story. He, on the other hand, lived to see the resurgence of his work. He hit his peak of popularity in the 20s with The Gay Divorce, which featured Night and Day. And The Gay Divorce is funny. They turned it into a movie right away, but they were afraid that censors would be upset with the idea of a happy divorce. So it was changed to The Gay Divorcee, the idea being that a divorced woman could be gay and happy, but not a divorce itself. That was too, you know, offensive
too scandalous
to the Christian sensibility.
I think that flies even to this day, though. Like, surely the idea of conscious uncoupling caused so many ruffled feathers, not just for its pretentiousness, but also because that's just anathema to how we even, like, we still cling to the idea that the loss of a marriage must be like a death, right?
Mm. And then the play Anything Goes opened later in the 30s, I think it was 34, which featured the song Anything Goes. It featured I Get a Kick Out of You, which became an endless jazz standard, and You're the Top, which we listened to at the beginning. So he was on the top of the entertainment world in 34 when Anything Goes came out, but his carefree life came to an end just 3 years later. While horseback riding in New York, his horse was spooked and it fell on his leg, crushing it and breaking it in several places. Porter opted to keep the leg so that he could still work the piano pedals, but he spent the rest of his life in severe chronic pain. He underwent 8 further surgeries, but the pain never went away. He lost his relevance at the center of the showbiz social life, and his professional career declined. Cole Porter took on a more steady career of writing tunes for movie musicals. Weirdly, he wrote Don't Fence Me In for a cowboy film, which was a flop, but then it was later resurrected for other cowboy films in the 40s.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in.
So that's weird that that's a Cole Porter song. Porter found that writing for film studios was very profitable, if unfulfilling, for him. Most of his work during this time has largely been forgotten, but some of it we know because it was plagiarized so much.
By other people, or he was plagiarizing when he wrote it?
So often by MGM, because he was an MGM employee.
Oh, okay.
And it's because studios at the time kept actors and writers under these long ironclad contracts, and other studios rarely poached talent and rarely undermined these contracts. Like when it would happen, it would be this huge deal because it was so rare. So as a result, Porter couldn't sue MGM for stealing his songs because he worked for MGM, and he threatened it would basically be the end of his career if he asserted himself in court for his songwriting credits. So that's tough.
Yeah,
when you're an American legend.
That is, to me, it's not unbelievable to me that a studio would operate that way, but that it would be someone who was at that point so famous, so well known, so respected.
Yeah. And and part of it is because they were paying him out the nose for his songs, because he commanded this huge rate and everything. But a way to get around that is to then plagiarize it. You know, if that song, The Pirate was a flop, so then they were like, well, we'll just reuse that, but not credit you.
Be a clown is ours.
That might be a success. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm sure the studio execs at the time were like, this is intellectual property. Cool. Yep. Sit down.
Basically. So anyway, we're nearing the end of his life. Cole Porter's mother died in 52. His wife died in 54. She had emphysema for much of her life, and she was older than Cole Porter as well. And by 58, his leg had developed life-threatening ulcers. So he underwent 34 more operations before they finally amputated the leg.
Wow, he really did not want to lose that leg.
Yeah, seriously. His friend Noel Coward... He said, the lines of ceaseless pain have been wiped from his face. I'm convinced that his whole life will cheer up and that his work will profit accordingly. But unfortunately, Porter never wrote another song, and he lived in seclusion for the last years of his life in the Waldorf Towers in New York until his death of kidney failure in 1964. He was 73 at the time. But as I mentioned earlier, he lived long enough to see his work included in the pantheon of American greats. In 1956, Americans were still listening to Night and Day, but they were listening to it like this.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling.
Later, MGM released High Society, which starred Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Grace Kelly, and Louis Armstrong, and it was based around the work of Cole Porter. Porter was involved in it, and he wrote a few new songs, and this is one of the new songs that he wrote, so this is about 10 years before the end of his life.
Well, you take some skins, jazz begins, and you take a bass. Man, now we're getting someplace. Take a box, one that rocks. Now you have jazz, 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 jazz.
That's Billy Kyle. Marvel Shaw.
Now you has Mr. Barrett Deans. Listen to,
well, you know who.
So, Porter got pretty hip by the 50s.
Yeah, a box that rocks.
I cut out also the first one that he says is the clarinetist, and it's get a stick, one with a lick. Yeah. So I would love to leave this on a harmonious note and say, look, these black performers found their way into popular acclaim. All those names you just heard were black performers. They're being seen on screen alongside with white performers. I would like to say that by the 50s, these black performers were finding their voice and were being more included in things. So the thing that undercuts that is that every name you just heard Bing Crosby give was wrong. He misnamed all of those performers. He gave them all each other's names. It was completely random.
What?
So despite the growing support for desegregation and the growing respect for black contributions, Bing Crosby couldn't name these guys correctly, and it went out to the public that way. This is how it was released. You know, nobody fixed it. Nobody on set said anything. Nobody in the editing booth said anything. So there's still some work to be done.
Yes. No one said anything?
It's just hard to believe that something can go to press like that, you know?
No, I know. And that they wouldn't be embarrassed, that there wouldn't be a collective embarrassment for not even being able to name your fellow musicians correctly.
In a section of the song that is explicitly supposed to be giving them credit. So that's the musicals of the 20s through the 40s, as I have discovered them.
What a good time period, though, in terms of music. So problematic, yeah. But I thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's a lot of history to dig at. Definitely, there was the story was a million times more complicated and bigger than what I initially set out to tell.
Yeah.
Because once you start digging into the roots of American music, there's just no way to not go down that minstrel rabbit hole and realize how racist our roots of popular music are in the U.S.
Yeah. I mean, I think that can be said about anything about American history, though, sadly.
It's definitely a major... When half of your country builds its society on a racial divide, that's something that's going to stick with you.
Yeah.
For a long, long time. It needs to slowly be dismantled at every step along the process. So, I don't know. But I also want to look at, like, not looking at Al Jolson in blackface and being like, he's the most racist human, you know? Because this was not a one-man or a two-man operation. And in fact, some of these guys who were performing that way were kind of on the forefront of dismantling that system.
Yeah. And I think it's exactly what you said at the beginning. Like, you have to look at these things even if they make you uncomfortable. And there is a way to censor someone by just saying, well, he must have been a terrible person. That was a one-time incident, instead of seeing him within a larger cultural context that was happening at the time and is still in many ways happening now.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's well put. So next time we'll look at, if I can get you on the phone again, look at the 50s and 60s will probably be the next step. So definitely Rodgers and Hammerstein will be a big part of that. And then we're starting to tiptoe into my absolute favorite, Sondheim and Bernstein, will be coming up soon.
Listeners, it'll be like three episodes and you won't be able to bear it. His unbridled enthusiasm.
Well, it'll be a 10 episode set on Bernstein, on how he created American music as we understand it. but to leave on a somewhat happy note, I do want to go back to Tom Lehrer was that comedian parodist that I played in Gilbert and Sullivan a little bit. So yeah. I want to show you another part of that same song. So he talks about the folk song Clementine, and he says folk songs are terrible because they're written by the people. So what if folk songs could have been written by great songwriters? So we heard his Gilbert and Sullivan, Oh My Darling Clementine. Now this is his Cole Porter, Oh My Darling Clementine.
She was so pretty, what a pity, Clementine. Oh, Clementine, can't you tell from the howls of me, this love of mine calls to you from the bowels of me. Are you discerning the returning of this churning, burning, yearning for you? Supposing at this point.
Of course there would be churning, yearning, burning in the Cole Porter version.
Yep.
Oh, I loved it.
All right. Well, this is my unlikely explanation. ¶¶